I'm Charlie Rose.
I'm Nora O'Donnell.
And I'm Gail King. Hey, this is a CBS This Morning podcast.
I'm Nora O'Donnell. Welcome to CBS This Morning. It's a special podcast. We're calling it the Seoul Sisters podcast because we're talking about our return from Seoul, South Korea, where we recently interviewed the new president of South Korea, President Moon Jae-in. And I had an incredible producing team with me, Olivia Andrzejczak, Jenna Gibson, Lauren Gallippo, and Chris Leibel, who is our Beijing-based producer. I'm so excited to talk about this because there were so many things that don't make air. But Jenna, maybe we'll start with you. I mean, how this all came about. I mean, the process of actually landing the interview.
Yeah, so I guess we started talking to the South Koreans about 3 weeks to a month ago. I was actually on vacation in Napa, and I was corresponding with the network president here, David Rhodes, about putting in an official pitch because he thought we had a real shot, given your background about growing up in Seoul. And so I took some time to sit and write out an official pitch letter for the South Koreans and then sent it to a couple of folks around here to take a look at. Put it in, put some good time into it. We actually wrote it in both English and Korean to make sure that we reached the target audience. And it really started snowballing from there. We got back pretty quick interest to say this is something they were interested in doing. We actually originally pitched to do this in D.C. because, as everybody knows, President Moon is coming here this week to meet with President Trump. And they came back and said, actually, his time is really, really tight. So would you guys be interested in coming to South Korea? And then we came to you with that to see if your busy schedule could accommodate it.
And one of the reasons this interested me, Olivia, I mean, the whole Korean Peninsula, I've been interested in it for decades because I grew up there. But I think certainly in this administration, we've heard from top officials that it's the top national security threat.
Absolutely. You've heard that from Secretary of Defense Mattis, who said that North Korea poses the most urgent threat to national security. And it's timely for so many other reasons. I mean, President Moon was swept into office following an unprecedented impeachment scandal of his predecessor and essentially had no time to put together a cabinet. I mean, he's still putting that together today. And he was swept into office on what wasn't quite an anti-American message, but it was certainly less pro-American than the conservative governments that had preceded his. You know, he said, we need to stand up to Washington. We need to, I mean, most notably, engage in dialogue with the North Koreans, which is something that had not happened in South Korea, had not been pushed for in South Korea for close to a decade with the conservative governments. President Moon is this very interesting figure who's going to have a very interesting time navigating diplomacy with President Trump, who, as we all know, has called for increased diplomatic pressure on North Korea, which is at cross purposes, essentially, with a campaign promise of President Moon.
So it's rare that we get to hear from all of you, and so this podcast, what was it like sitting there? Because we had a little bit of a technical difficulty right before the interview where the translation wouldn't work, and the new president is sort of sitting there, and I had to kind of make small talk. What was it like for all of you sitting there?
I would say it was a little bit stressful. So my responsibility is to communicate with the South Koreans. And luckily, they were very, very understanding and very nice. I think they were gracious of our time to come there. And so that probably helped. But sitting there with a translator, because I don't speak Korean, we were explaining what was going on. And at one point, I remember she asked, well, would it help if we all turned our cell phones off? Because it was just a technical glitch. And I said, it's a really good idea, but probably not. So just give us a couple minutes and we'll get back on track here. And they did. And of course, the president made a comment about Nora and how beautiful she was. She said, I think it was the first time meeting you, you're a true beauty or something along those lines. And that really broke the ice for everybody. And they started laughing. We started laughing. And at that point, I think we all knew it was going to be okay. And it was.
Well, and we originally had 40 minutes once we actually started, but they ended up giving us over an hour of time.
Yeah, absolutely. Coming in, we had kind of a set out time and they were leaning over, watching the clock and saying, it's going very well, it's going very well. So they were nice enough to extend it because to your point, and I think to Nora's credit, they knew that this was going to be good.
That's right. And our nails will grow back eventually, I think.
after biting them down to the
exactly.
Well, you were biting your nails. I was making jokes too. I said, "I'm sorry, Mr. President, we should have used Samsung equipment for this for this particular interview, given that Samsung, of course, is based there in South Korea, and of course, one of their major industries." It was interesting to see how much news our interview made in South Korea.
That was one of my favorite parts. I think waking up the next morning and seeing the Korean papers and your face and CBS written all over it. Everything's in Korean except for the three letters in English, CBS, and Nora's face.
Oh, sure. And on TV, too. I mean, it got a ton of pickup, notably because, I mean, this is a president who, you know, he didn't quite reverse course, but he said some things that were very much contrary to what he campaigned on. So he was very much complimentary of President Trump. He said that, you know, achieving peace on the Korean Peninsula would obviously be, you know, his greatest diplomatic achievement if he could work towards reestablishing dialogue with the North Koreans. So, you know, it doesn't surprise me that you were spread across the front pages of the papers, just because this is such a closely scrutinized issue, and one that's only going to become more important as the summit approaches.
Yeah, that's. I think that's worth talking about, because as I'm sitting there conducting the interview and listening and waiting for the translation and thinking about where I'm going to go next, the three of you are furiously taking notes and starring. What were some of the highlights for you, Jenna?
Well, I thought that the biggest headline coming out was how friendly he appeared to be toward the Trump administration, because going back to what Olivia said in our prep and research, he wasn't quite as friendly in the campaign. So hearing that, I thought was very interesting. The fact that he kind of pulled back a bit on some of the dialogue that he had originally proposed with North Korea was very interesting, because it almost was as if he knew he was speaking to an American audience, but also to his own constituents. And to see a bit of a shift in that, I thought was really fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Lauren?
You know, my favorite part that I starred was obviously when he talked about Trump saying that he would have a hamburger with Kim Jong-un, because obviously, you know, when you asked him about Kim Jong-un being a madman and wanting to have that knee-to-knee, head-to-head conversation with him, you know, I think a lot of people here in the States obviously see North Korea as more of a threat. So I thought it was interesting being in South Korea, especially among the people who actually live there day to day, what a difference it was. So
it was almost like President Moon was sort of defending his decision to want to meet with Kim Jong-un by saying, well, your own president has said he wants to share.
Exactly. He took it even further.
Yeah. A burger with him. I mean, you know, that's, you would share a burger with a family member or with a close friend.
Sure, but he was quick also to reassure on several issues. I mean, especially on the THAAD deployment, he said, "Look, it's going to get there. We just need to sort of make sure we make good on this environmental investigation," which, you know, some people had decried as a concession to the Chinese, that the delay of this anti-missile system that the Chinese had criticized because of this powerful radar that they said would jeopardize its own national security. You know, some people saw President Moon's decision to delay that deployment as a concession to them. But he said, no, it's going to be put in place. And something that had caused something of a flurry of headlines just before, there was some insinuation by one of his advisors in Washington that the South Koreans would be willing to scale back joint military exercises with the United States, which is a longstanding military tradition, which is at equal parts symbolic and important, just to keep everybody ready for for combating an eventual North Korean threat. And he was very firm on that front too. He said, "No, that's an informal advisor who floated that possibility, and we are committed to the joint exercise. That's not something that we're considering scaling back."
Yeah, and that was interesting, because that had created a lot of waves at the State Department, this suggestion by the South Koreans that they would scale back these joint ROK U.S. military exercises, ROK standing for the Republic of Korea, which, as you note, Olivia, that he walked that back in the interview. It wasn't until the next day when Lauren and I went on a Black Hawk tour of Camp Humphreys and spent some time with Army soldiers who are on the front line, that I really got a sense of that significance of what that scaling back would mean. And we spoke with Major General Tammy Smith, who is the highest ranking woman commander at Yongsan Army Base, which is where I grew up 30 years ago. And one of the things that she pointed out in our interview while we were aboard a Black Hawk circling Seoul and on our way south to Camp Humphreys was that the type of cooperation between the U.S. and South Korean forces is unprecedented anywhere in the world. They work side by side on these U.S. Army bases. They share intelligence. South Korea is the number one purchaser of U.S. Military equipment, tied with Saudi Arabia. So we are so close with the South Koreans. So any suggestion by an advisor to the new president that they would scale back that cooperation probably not just sent shockwaves through the State Department here, but also through many military offices as well.
Just flying over Camp Humphreys, the housing facilities, the high school, the middle school, the football stadiums that they're building for these kids, you can tell they're investing a lot in it and they're there to stay, right?
Is that because Nora's fourth grade classroom needed some updating? Or?
Yeah, it's the same. Was apparently the elementary school was brand new when I got there. So, but 33 years later, the updates included a new television on the wall. But yeah. Other than that, a lot of it was very similar, and a new playground, but a lot of it was very similar. So clearly they're investing in the future with Camp Humphreys. But you know, that's always it's always great to be up in one of these Black Hawk helicopters.
They
and thank
really
you
cool.
to the U.S. Army pilots who flew us over Camp Humphreys. And then we landed at Osan Air Base, where we got to meet with soldiers from the 35th Artillery, who told us this, and they're essentially called the 35th Air Defense Artillery Brigade, who showed us the Patriot missiles, which are the first line of defense. So essentially, you know, they shoot up a missile and it hits an incoming ballistic missile from North Korea. And hopefully they meet in the air and explode, and that reduces the threat to South Korea. That's just for short and medium range missiles. But on a personal level, in speaking with them, I got a little choked up because they are so selfless in their description of their service, you know what I mean, about what they do for their country. And it reminded me, and I know this growing up in a military family, but being there, it's hard on a family when you're deployed in a foreign country, the threat of North Korea growing, and the way they talk about serving their country, I think, is a role model for everyone. It's why we all hold our military in such high regard. So I'm glad we got to spend a great deal of time with them 2 days during our trip to Seoul.
They're really the first line of defense when it comes to North Korea. Mm-hmm. And one of the co-pilots was probably, you know, a little over 21 years old, fresh out of college or, you know, moving to a foreign country and had never been out of the States before. Mm-hmm. So
you got the young pilot. I got one of the more veteran pilots.
But it is such a good reminder to put the faces to the people that are defending our country every day, even though,
absolutely,
you know, they're overseas. And even the chief of staff, Colonel Taylor, said that his wife and kids are actually here in the States for the summer. So it really does take a toll on families.
And it was such a helpful illustration. I mean, the president sort of pointed this out too. I mean, people on the ground in South Korea live with a life or death threat every day. You know, I mean, when you talk about a preemptive strike, when you talk in theory about, you know, the tens of thousands of lives that can be lost within the first day, you know, of God forbid, an artillery fire, you know, I think you guys did such a good job illustrating what the preparation is. You know, you pointed out mostly the defensive weapons, right? I mean, presumably there's an offensive capability there too, but this was an illustration of the defensive capabilities of the United States military, right?
Yeah, and that's what the U.S. military wanted to show us, the defensive, not the offense. And I think that there's a reason for that. I mean, we all talked to a number of military experts, and there are not many good options. And they say there is no good military option, which is why the return to diplomacy in the Trump administration is noteworthy.
Mm-hmm. It seemed interesting, too, to sit at Yongsan and talk to these men and women who are so proud to be there. And they know, like you said, President Moon pointed out that whereas this is a future threat for the U.S., in South Korea, this is a life or death situation. And yet, in speaking with these folks in the military, they're very well aware of it, but it's not something that's maybe on their forefront every single day. You know, we asked, is there some sort of protective plan? And they told you that each family had gas masks at the ready should something happen. But at the same time, you know, the kids are playing in the pool, they're on the swings, and they're going about their daily lives. So while it is such an obvious threat, it's also something that maybe I was a little surprised that people weren't more concerned, because we talk about this every single day. And for them, it's their daily lives that they're still living, and the South Koreans as well.
Yeah. And I don't really think that it hits home until, I mean, I remember being at the hotel and opening a drawer and there was a flashlight, a fire extinguisher, and a smoke escape mask. Yeah. So, you know, like that's just, it is a reality people contend with. Although, I mean, you hear that just because they've been living with this for decades now, you know, especially the younger generations are almost blasé toward it. I mean, there's apparently something of a thriving youth, you know, youthful neighborhood right near the DMZ where, you know, where apparently, you know, it's just not thought of in terms of a daily life or death situation. It's thought of as, well, the rockets are going to go right over us and into the
Busan,
central capital,
I think,
anyway.
Where some of these younger generations are moving closer to the border because, like you said, they think it's safer.
That's their calculus.
You know, if there's an attack, they're not going to strike their own country.
Yeah. The Eighth Army is headquartered, of course, in South Korea, and their motto is ready to fight tonight. And so they're ready all the time. They prepare all the time, as you said. And so they live under this constant threat, and they plan for it and prepare for it. One of the things when we visited the 35th Artillery Brigade, and that was at Osan Air Base, is we talked to them about the advancement in the ballistic missile system of the North Koreans. And this is something, you know, we've read a lot about, and I think it's just worth talking about, because what's happened essentially in the last, you know, even just 6 months, has been not only the rapid increase in the pace of the missile attacks by the North, but also what appears to be an advancement in their technology. Mm-hmm. So first, in the pace of their attacks, there have been now 10 missile attacks
this year alone.
Just this year.
Five under President Moon, since President Moon took office.
Right, and that's only been a month.
Right,
essentially. So there's an increasingly aggressive stance by the North Koreans, whether to send a message, to get concessions, whatever it may be. This is ramping up to a degree that we have not seen before. And in terms of the technology, two interesting things. One, the idea that the North Koreans could test an ICBM this year, an intercontinental ballistic missile that could reach the United States. And then two, the type of missiles that they're launching. Usually the North launches these liquid fuel missiles. Two of the recent ones have been solid fuel missiles. And I asked Colonel Rick Wright, who's with the 35th Air Defense Artillery Brigade, about that. He's the commander. And he said that is significant. The fact that the North launched two solid fuel missiles is significant because they can move those really quickly, get them ready to launch really quickly, which means it makes it more difficult for U.S. intelligence to spot when they're going to launch one of these things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in between the tests, and you've seen just recently a real escalation in the rhetoric, whereas before President Trump seemed to have escaped criticism from the North Korean regime, you see today in the papers that there's been some very strong language, you know, sort of lobbed against the president and the administration for, you know, what appears to be a sort of deteriorating diplomatic situation, something that President Moon is going to have to navigate very carefully when he gets here on Thursday.
Yeah, that's why this summit is going to be really interesting, to see how he responds to President Trump, how President Trump responds to him. I mean, President Moon did critique President Trump's predecessors for not doing enough. And like we all said, he still wants to have this dialogue with the North because he believes that Kim Jong-un's number one responsibility is to protect its own regime. And if they strike anything, that's going to put them immediately at jeopardy.
In terms of courting the Americans and working with them, and at the same time trying to achieve dialogue.
Exactly.
With the North.
I mean, President Moon is the son of North Korean refugees. He's a human rights lawyer by training. He is, I mean, I don't know your impression of him, Nora, but I think he seemed relatively calm and soft-spoken. He's known for being very humble. So, I mean, personality-wise, you could see how he's pretty close to diametrically opposed from somebody like President Trump. So even the clash of personalities there is, to the extent there's a clash, is going to be interesting to observe.
Looking towards in terms of what's next, mm-hmm. one of the last questions that we were able to squeeze in at the end is you guys were saying rap, 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 and I kept trying to ask more questions, as is always the case in these presidential interviews and others. As you know, it happens here in the United States at the White House. It happened at the Blue House as well. One of the questions at the end of the interview that I asked is, will you be able to meet with Kim Jong-un this year? Mm-hmm. And what was his answer?
I mean, he answered it by saying, I certainly hope that the conditions are right for such a meeting to take place. Maybe not take place, but to be arranged. I mean, you know, after the fact, we had something of a conversation with some of the members of his administration, and they were quick to clarify that that is not something that they expect to happen. That's not something that they believe is a reasonable timeline. But, you know, if the president, apparently being the optimist that he is in this situation, seemed to say, you know, I hope we can bring about a situation in which that would be possible.
Yeah. As I recall, even there was a suggestion not only that President Moon of South Korea could meet Kim Jong-un, right. but that President Trump could That's at right. some point meet the North Korean dictator, which to me was surprising. I mean, even that image of the two of them meeting was kind of hard to imagine.
Right. And it's also important to remember that there are more than just two countries or three countries, the U.S., South Korea, and North Korea, involved in this. It's a whole regional effort and a global effort. China has to be involved. Japan has to be involved. So this is not something that's achieved overnight by any stretch of the imagination.
Or unilaterally or even bilaterally. Very good point. Yeah.
So what did you guys think of Seoul?
I loved it. I thought the city was great. I thought it was very clean. It seemed very inviting. The people were incredibly nice. You can always tell, I think, if you travel abroad, that even if there's a language barrier, there's still mannerisms that you can read amongst each other. So it's a lot of pointing, mm-hmm. a lot of nodding. People seem to understand, yes.
I mean, Jenna, you perfected your Korean. I know you did.
I got kamsahamnida, which is still wrong. The girls here will point out.
No.
But no, I got very good at saying kamsahamnida to everybody because everybody was so nice. And everyone was just, I thought, very inviting, mm-hmm. which is very helpful to someone traveling abroad who does not speak the language.
I mean, and we didn't see all that much of it because we were essentially in and out over the course of very few days. But from what we know about it, it is extremely densely populated. I mean, half the country lives in Seoul. It's 25 million people, right? It's mm-hmm. the most among the most wired capitals. Like 90% of households have access to broadband internet. And I was struck by seeing just how much American influence there was. There were a ton mm-hmm. of Starbucks, KFCs, Taco Bell, mm-hmm. like right in close range of all of us with sort of different
And at the
menus,
same time, the street markets still exist.
Sure do.
Decades later, which I think are such an explosion of South Korean culture. And, you know, women there making the most incredible food, you know, frying it up, chopping vegetables.
And it's all live and fresh. Yeah. Every alive. Fish yeah. was live. You I mean, there was nothing frozen.
See our Instagram feed, right? For the octopus. I think you posted that, Lauren.
Yes, the live octopus, the sea urchin.
I thought the food was really good. Remember that dinner we had?
The one yeah. dinner we managed to have as a group, essentially, yeah.
Yeah, Korean barbecue. We all sat down as a big group, all, what, 13 of us?
There was not room at the table.
Yeah, it was side to side. It's definitely more like New York City where you're all sitting almost on top of each other. And then the waitress is actually coming over and preparing your food freshly on a grill in front of you.
Snipping the beef apart yeah. with scissors, putting more kimchi and kimchi pancakes and scallion pancakes Delicious. And noodles, glass noodles. I mean, I don't. Yeah. remember all of it, but there was a lot. There was
but
not
then
room.
Keeping in mind that we're on a 13-hour time difference, and it was, I guess, what, 9 p.m. or something, and we decided we need to file something, or we were asked to file something for evening news.
That was one of the hardest parts, because I know even the crew had been up since like 6 in the morning, and at that point it was now about 10:30 at mm-hmm. night. We had just finished being live on CBS This Morning at essentially what was 7 a.m. and 8 a.m., and then made it to dinner, and then we're sitting there finally for the first time really sitting down to get to enjoy this fabulous Korean barbecue. And then Jenna says, oh, we have one more thing we need to do. We need to file for evening news.
I had a pretty good track record up until then.
But I thought, but it does speak, Jenna, and I'm glad the president of CBS News was there to see how hard all of you work, that it's nonstop. Even the crew got up from dinner to go set up. You walked out to go help the crew, Jenna, have them set up. Olivia and Laura immediately, Lauren and I huddled, you know, over our bulgogi and our glass noodles to sort of write our script for evening news. Mm-hmm. All of this done so quickly, yeah. And try and do it incredibly accurately and interesting in a way too. And at that point, it's even late into the night, and get it done quickly so that the crew can get to bed because they've got the earliest.
You had to turn around and get right back up.
And Maris mentioned we're all contending with terrible jet lag, which is unlike what I thought jet lag would even feel like, because it was not just being tired, it was being dizzy and disoriented and having trouble focusing on people's faces. At least how I experienced it for a time. It's a long travel time, you know.
You did a great job then.
Well, yeah, I'm glad it was semi-coherent.
But it was also fortunate for us, and I think for viewers, that everything was so genuinely done. And we decided, all right, the crew is so good at what they do that they said, we can set up right here. We don't have to go back to an old Imperial Palace. Mm-hmm. We have a beautiful shot down the street of what South Korea in Seoul really looks like. And you had this great nighttime view of all this busyness behind you, I thought. So you literally walked out of the restaurant and stood up on your box and delivered the news.
It was just so interesting to be there. Obviously we kind of stuck out just because we had a camera crew with us, but people were very excited to have, you know, not exposure, but just to have people there. You know, they're inviting us in to eat. And I thought it was very welcoming.
Yeah, they seemed genuinely interested to know why we were there, who we were, and what we were doing. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of people would come up, especially with Nora and a camera, and say, "Who in Korean, you know, who is she? Is she famous?" Yeah. And our translator would say, "Yes, she's famous." And then they would just snap pictures. But I think they were curious to know. And then when we did tell them why we were there to interview their president, then they became even more interested.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, the South Koreans have been living with a large American presence for a long time, certainly since the end of the Korean War. So it's been 60 plus years. And when I was there 30 years ago, they were very welcoming. And very grateful to the American military. Even President Moon, in our interview, when I asked him, you know, what's it like being the son of North Korean refugees, he first thanked the U.S. military, said that a ship helped get his parents out of North Korea to bring them to the South. He said, if it weren't for the U.S. military, I wouldn't be alive. And that's really, I think, the view for the most part of his generation. The younger generation is, I think, more nationalistic. And they are perhaps don't see the historical significance of having the U.S. military there, or don't feel that they may not need it anymore. And so that kind of, if it's anti-Americanism or pro their own government, is in part what led to this new administration. So it has shifted, but everyone was incredibly welcoming and lovely to us. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
sure. Yeah. And it's a saying in South Korea that, I mean, they sometimes consider themselves a shrimp between two whales. I mean, the sort of smaller power lodged between whoever it is at the time, you know, back in the day, it was the Japanese and the Mongolians. And now it's, you know, it's essentially China and the United States, where this is a very proud nation with a lot of rich history that is navigating a very, very tense diplomatic situation. I mean, you know, between keeping the Chinese relatively reassured that American military support in South Korea is not a destabilizing force for the Chinese, and, you know, saying to the North Koreans, we don't approve of your nuclear program, you need to dismantle it, but also let's have a dialogue. I mean, that is a very, very tricky diplomatic situation for the president and his entire administration. Yeah.
Well, thanks to all of you for a really successful trip. And we look forward to coming back to another podcast after our next foreign journey. We're welcoming suggestions about where to go next. Annyeonghaseyo.
Thank you for listening. You can watch the full CBS This Morning broadcast Monday through Saturday from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. on your local CBS station.
Or you can stream it live on the CBS All Access app.
For more information, please visit cbsthismorning.com.